Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast with your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of the Mill Creek View newspaper.
Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast. We are focused on our nation today with always an interesting person making a positive change in our community. This time, special guest, Jay Warner Wallace. But first, for more information about the Mill Creek View podcast, visit us anywhere you get your podcasts and socials at Mill Creek View, Tennessee. While you're there, please subscribe. And welcome to our People in the News episode, where I interview people who are making an impact and are lovers of truth. Today, we are talking with Jay Warner Wallace, author of Person of Interest, Why Jesus Still Matters in a World That Rejects the Bible, amongst other books. Jim is married to Susie, who loved his life since 1979, and has four children. He lives in Southern California, where he enjoys running on the beach and trails and walking his trusted corgi, Bailey. He's a Dateline featured cold case homicide detective, popular national speaker, and best-selling author. Jay Warner's professional investigative work has received national recognition. His cases have been featured more than any other detective on NBC's Dateline, and his work has also appeared on Court TV and Fox News. He also appears on television as an investigative consultant and had a role in God's Not Dead 2, making the case for the historicity of Jesus. Jay Warner was awarded the Police and Fire Medal of Valor Sustained Superiority Award for his continuing work on cold case homicides and the Cops West Award after solving a 1979 murder. Relying on over two decades of investigative experience, Jay Warner provides his readers and audiences with the tools they need to investigate the claims of Christianity and make a convincing case for the truth of the Christian worldview. Hello, Jim. How are you today?
Thanks so much for having me. Doing great. How are you?
Doing great. Thank you. SoCal getting some unusual weather. Not fair to have high taxes and bad weather. Are you hanging in there?
Yeah, actually, we have had a few more days of rain this year, but today it is beautiful and, you know, typical. For us, it's always between 60 and 85. Yeah. So where I am anyway. So we're right in that range right now.
Well, thanks for taking time away from the sun. Sure. Be indoors with me. I appreciate
glad
it.
To do it.
Now you have several books on this subject. Jesus Really Lives, 9, including 3 for kids. For today's show prep, I read Person of Interest, Why Jesus Still Matters in a World That Rejects the Bible, mostly because you autographed it for me and gave me your email so I could book you for this show. So thank you
glad
for that
it. Yeah,
very much. Here it is, dog-eared and underlined as always. Which was your favorite book to write?
Probably the one I'm writing right now. Those books are important to me. They just kind of chart my own investigation of Christianity. But you know, as you get older, you start thinking about generally, just wisdom in life in general. How do you navigate life well? And you can learn a lot about how to navigate life by working homicides, by working death, because you see where things went sideways. So this next book is kind of 15 principles for living life that come from investigating deaths.
Wow, that's very interesting. I can't wait. Your last book was Cold Case Christianity, A Homicide Detective Investigates the Claims of the Gospel. You used your nationally recognized skills as a homicide detective to look at the evidence and eyewitnesses behind Christian beliefs. Buy that one too, everybody. Any comments on that book?
Yeah, that was actually my first book, and we did that. Now the 10th anniversary is getting ready to release. We kind of rewrote it and re-illustrated it, and now it releases, I think, in September of this year. So we're getting ready to release a new edition of that. But yeah, it's been a great joy to that looks at all the evidence for Christianity from kind of inside the yellow tape. You know, when you do murders, you have evidence that's in the yellow tape that you're going to use in trial. And you also have a bunch of evidence that's outside the yellow tape. You know, you're going to do a search warrant at his house later. You're going to talk to a bunch of people. There's all kinds of evidence that's not in the crime scene that actually is going to demonstrate whether or not he's the killer. And so Cold Case just looks at the stuff that's inside the yellow tape. A Person of Interest, for example, looks at everything that's outside the yellow tape. If you didn't have a New Testament, what would you still know about Jesus from what's outside the yellow tape? And that's kind of the approach I took looking at both of these. I was not a believer until I was 35. And I was pretty skeptical about not just the claims of Christianity, but the people who claimed Christianity was true. So for me, I had to look at both what's inside and outside and build a cumulative case before I could even entertain the idea that it was saying anything true.
Right. You were an atheist before you came to this conclusion, right? So it helped you flush out your own beliefs.
Well, pretty much everyone on my team. There wasn't a believer on my team at the police department. And so most of my work, I was just surrounded by people who weren't believers. And I was raised that way. There's no one in my family who's a believer. So it was just for me. I mean, I'm sure there were some theists in my family, but we had never heard the gospel presented until we stepped foot in that church. And we probably didn't hear it there for a couple of weeks. But for me, I just went over my head. I didn't care because I got to know, number one, everyone thinks something is true.
Right.
But I wanted to make sure this was true before I took a step.
Yeah. And that is the amazing part, is that you were able to say, even if all of the old, well, if there was never a New Testament ever written down on paper, there are so many other angles to prove this, that it just has to be true by observation. And we'll get into more details on that too. But, and for those that run out and buy Person of Interest, which you should, no, I'm not the Steve that killed his wife. Steve, the producer, might be. No, just kidding. Whatever happened to Steve? Is he still in jail?
No, yeah. So these guys, this particular case, as all my books, what I try to do is take the, 25 years worth of stuff and mix and match it. And I always say that in the beginning of the book. You're going to get truth in the book, but not every detail is from that case. I'm plucking it out of some other case, mostly because I'm in California, where any case can be overturned. And probably will be. So you want to make sure that you don't, hurt any future investigation, any future case. And also you want to be sensitive to victims. So there's a couple times in my books, like the one I'm writing right now, where my wife will say, that's almost too close. Like, you could identify that case. If you were to watch enough Dateline, you would know that you're talking about that case. And then I'll make a change so that it's not as obvious. But in that particular, it's based primarily on a case where actually Steve has been released on parole about 2 years ago. So yeah, that happens sometimes.
Wow.
And the view is that hey, if he hasn't committed another, if look, all cold case murderers spend the next 30 years behaving as though they are your best citizens in the community. This is how they got away with it for 30 years. I mean, if they didn't do that, they would have been caught again for another murder. They're not serial murderers. They are cold case killers. That means they did one thing really bad 30 years ago, and then they basically covered it and pretended like they didn't do it for the next 30 years. And so what you have is people who, from all outward standards, you would say, well, why shouldn't you release this guy? He's been an upstanding citizen. He just killed one woman, his wife, 30 years ago. So we have to ask ourselves as a culture, do we think that somebody who kills somebody 30 years ago and then spends 30 years free, like, he was paroled for the first 30. Does he need to serve another 30 now or 25? Or do we just, he served six. So the question then becomes, what value do we assign these things? What level of punishment do we think is appropriate? What do we think about punishment? All these questions are up right now for to be re-asked, not just in California, but you're in the Middle Coast, right? So where you guys are is, trust me, the rate at which this is moving is much faster where you are than even where I am. It's already arrived where I am. It's moving there where you are. And that's true for all of us in California, near any urban area, is that now we're reassessing what is right, what is wrong, what is good, what does it mean to be, who should we incarcerate, who should we not incarcerate, how long should we incarcerate them? Yeah. So these are questions we're all asking now.
And you live in California, where the district attorney who came down from San Francisco has been infamous now for releasing criminals maybe a little earlier than thought. Has any of your hard work leading to a case been dishearteningly overturned by him not prosecuting like he's supposed to?
It's ridiculous, the amount.
I
consult with the DAs who are still working for George Gascon, still working in his office, who have now been moved to various far district,
Siberia.
Basically, DA office Siberia, because they have been outspoken about their opposition to Gascon, and so now they have been moved to these little nooks and crannies where they can have no voice. And there's a number of lawsuits. One was just one, I think, yesterday or the day before yesterday, for $1.5 million for somebody who was just moved out of her office because she opposed his. And by the way, when she's opposing it, what she's saying is, no, I think we should still stand for the state legislated statutes, right, that have been in place for years. We're not here to rewrite those. We're here simply to enforce those. Those get rewritten at the state level. That's not our job as the DA. But what they can choose to do is simply not prosecute. And so in essence, you are rewriting the statute because you're not prosecuting the statute. Right. You just say pretending as though it doesn't exist. And so this is the kind of thing we are seeing, but this isn't just here.
Yeah.
These DAs exist everywhere. And what we are seeing is that this is pendulum-like. So for example, they just replaced the mayor of Chicago. And I'm sure if she was a liberal mayor, if she, I'm not even sure what her entire policies were, but they're going to end up voting back in place somebody who's liberal as well. But this liberal they vote in place will also be pro-police because she was pretty much voted out for anti-police perspective, right? So it turns out that you
similar to what we're seeing in New York City with Adams.
Yes, and I'm not a political person for the most part, but I think it's so fair for us to vote. I vote policy before politics and before people. So in this case, because I'm a police officer and I see how foundational that really reliable, good police work. Now, look, we've seen some examples of really bad police work.
Yeah.
And we all want to get rid of that because that even people, even those on the inside of this industry, we have no patience for that. But but we understand there's a role for fair, sound, ethical police work. There has to be. We are the one necessary profession upon which every other profession is contingent. Even up what we're doing today, talking about Christianity on a podcast, we would not be able to do if you were worried that in the next few minutes someone's going to break into your studio and take your gear. So it turns out the law enforcement is the one necessary that builds everything else is built on. And that's why it's so important that it be ethical. So that's
and you
why
you have long roots in Los Angeles. Your father and your grandfather were.
No, my father was there for 28 years. I was there, did my term, and now my son's been there for 11.
Your son, okay.
So we are there for three generations at the same agency with the same name. So yeah, I'm invested here. But also, you learn a lot of things when you work these kinds of investigations. You can apply to other aspects of life. You know, you can detecting deception is something that's useful whether you're working in law enforcement or you're just parenting your daughters.
Yes. So now when you go out speaking, what is the one or two most frequent arguments you hear against your investigations? Obviously, in a courtroom, anything you present, even if you know it is 100% factual, they're going to try to debunk it on the other side, the defense or the prosecutors. How do you what do you hear as the opposite side of your investigation of Jesus?
Well, typically it's going to come down to manuscript evidence, right? People are going to say that these gospels were written by anonymous sources late in the second or third century, well after the eyewitnesses, if there ever actually were any, would have actually been alive to write anything. So I think that's that was my complaint. That was my belief because I'd heard it so many times and I thought there's, you know, this is going to be some late, because why in the world would anyone include miracles in the accounts, right? You couldn't write that back when it actually happened because people would know you're lying. So you wait. If you want to lie about Jesus, the best thing to do is wait till everyone who knows the truth is dead. Then you can say anything you want. So I always assumed that this has got to be a late piece of fiction, because if it was an early piece of fiction, people would have called it out and said, no, it actually isn't fiction. Or they would have said, yeah, it is fiction. So the early dating of the Gospels was the very first line of evidence that, you know, we have a criteria for reliable eyewitness testimony. It's in my book, Cold Case Christianity. There's four pillars that determine if an eyewitness is reliable. And the very first one is, was he really present to see what he said he saw? And so if the Gospels are written in the second century, then you really can't, they could have some true information in them, but you can't call them eyewitness accounts because those guys have been dead for years. So you have to be able to say, well, how early were these written? Could they have been written either by eyewitnesses or at least in the lifetime of eyewitnesses who would know if they were telling the truth? That's only the first of four pillars, but it's an important first pillar. And so that's the first thing I had to do is, and you get that not from studying scripture, you get that from studying first century history to see, you know, how, is there any internal evidence in the Gospels that would give away their dating? And trust me, the skeptics who don't think that they, most skeptics will say they were written post 70. And they say that because they include, they don't include the destruction of the temple. But Jesus accurately predicted that. So they figure, well, if you're going to accurately predict it, it must be that it already happened. And therefore, you're just writing in it as a prediction. That's why they often will date Daniel so late in history, because they don't believe in an accurate prophecy. That's too supernatural. So you're always going to put it post 70, but there's no manuscript evidence to confirm. All the internal manuscript evidence points to an earlier date. So there's no reason to date it later. And so I think this is part of what you have to do, especially for young people. And because young people are not being taught this. As a matter of fact, this is the least religious generation in the history of America. And it's the true. Hemorrhaging we have seen in the church since COVID is striking. We have redefined what it is to be a church.
But we are blessed to be seeing a revival somewhere at about 30 campuses, which was a problem leading up to that notion. So we'll see where that takes us. Now, you get very animated when you talk about facts versus inferences mm-hmm. in relation to Jesus. So when you say, you know, you can't carbon date a notepad to say this was written 2 days after the crucifixion, how do you come up with facts versus inferences to help you narrow down your specificity?
Yeah, so there you go. For me, it's about, look, there's data that we present to a jury, and that's that evidence show the last any number of weeks. I was just helping with the DA here, just very, very small way on a case he had here last year, and that thing was a year in trial. It was stopped by COVID, it started again. It was a mess. I mean, that year, you're showing a lot of data to jurors, hoping they'll remember it, because from the data, the facts, and by the way, those facts are going to be presented to the jury in such a way that the defense is going to be able to argue whether they're reliable or not. But the inference is what the jury makes when it renders a verdict. There's a difference between facts and inferences from facts. I look at all the same facts about biology and cosmology and astrophysics, yet I infer a personal creator from those facts, whereas the atheist is going to infer either a quantum vacuum, you know, generator, or he's going to quantum universe generator, or he's going to infer that physics can somehow cause DNA information. However they're going to get there, they have to get there, make a different inference, but they're using the same facts that I'm using. So there's a difference between facts and inferences. You know, scientists don't say anything. I mean, science doesn't say anything. Scientists say things. Science provides us with facts. Scientists provide us with inferences. But you don't have to agree with the inference, because you might have the same facts in front of you and make a different inference. And we have a tendency to think that, wow, you know, you need to have really good scientific skills to make proper inferences. That's not true. You need really good scientific skills to glean the data. To glean the facts, because I don't have skills maybe in extracting DNA from certain things or breaking it down molecularly. I don't have that skill. But making the inference from what the scientist retrieves, that's just about clear thinking, logical thinking. And what you discover quickly is that scientists, even the most famous scientists you can think of, are not necessarily good thinkers philosophically. So it turns out if you can just be a good thinker philosophically, you could be anybody and make a better inference than a scientist who's not a good thinker. So well, just don't assume that one is the other. Okay. Because we've seen it over and over again. People will make statements that are so self-contradictory on the pages of their most famous books as scientists. And you think to yourself, well, that's a self-refuting statement right there. How'd you not see it? Because they aren't trained philosophers. Not that you and I are either. But I think what you do is you learn to make really good inferences from the evidence. We haven't ever lost a case. And we never had any direct evidence. We always had indirect evidence, which is also known as circumstantial evidence. And we haven't lost a case because we teach jurors how to be good thinkers first. And then we show them the data.
That was the amazing thing about the Steve case that we talked about. I forget the wife's name, or Tammy. The Tammy. Okay. Yeah. Because there was no body. There was not a body of Tammy, which makes your job all that much harder, because most juries want to say dead body equals murder. No body means missing person, right? Ran away.
And that's how that case was originally taken. It was taken as a missing person. And that makes it harder. No, DAs don't like no body murders, because you have to prove two things. Before you can prove he's the killer, you have to prove somebody was killed. And so what do? She might have just run off. So you have to really kind of make that case first. And I didn't go into this in this particular case, but we had to do a lot to demonstrate to the jury that the wife was actually dead before we could make a case against the husband.
Amazing. Okay, so the Gospels, they're reliable to you and me, but they have errors or variants, you wrote. What do you say to folks like that who say, well, it can't be true, there are errors?
Right. Well, so an error is different than a variant. So what you discover when you work criminal cases is that if the three of us who are here right now, you've got your producer, Steve, with us, and we're all in the same, you know, have communication with each other. If one event occurred for all of us, we would report it in three slightly different ways. I only know this because no witness ever, ever, ever entirely agrees. It's just the nature of doing this kind of work. I don't care if it happened 2 hours ago, 10 minutes ago, or 2 decades ago. we will have variations between the way we retell the story. And some of these variations will leave out key components that either we just didn't see because we're in a physically wrong place, or based on our interests and passions and desires and wiring, we missed that. We tunneled it out, or we were so focused on the gun that we didn't see what the shirt was, or that there was somebody standing right behind him. So was there somebody standing behind him? Like, no, he was standing right. Well, how do you reconcile these things? They might appear to be errors, even though you know all three people were in the room. It just happened 15 minutes ago. How could this be so different? Well, the great thing about real crime, about real time crimes, is that if I give you an example of this, it's not unusual. You have a murder. You have a team of five guys. We canvass the neighborhood. We get all these witnesses. We do all the interviews, put them on supplemental reports. I'm the case agent. I get all the reports in my lap. I look at those reports. And I'm like, wow, this guy says there were two people. This guy says there were one. Was there two angels or was there one at the tomb? Now, one report reports two angels. The other one only says there's one, but maybe he's just saying there's one because that's the one he was talking to. Don't know. In a real live case where you have access to your eyewitnesses, you can go back and just re-interview them. Like, I clearly got to call this guy. Hey, so when you were talking, I know you mentioned that you were talking to that angel. Was anyone else around? Well, yeah, there was another angel. Okay, that just didn't get in the report because nobody asked the clarification question. But in cold cases, my witnesses are usually dead. I can't ask clarification questions. So the apparent contradiction remains in the reports, and defense attorneys love it. But this does not mean there's an error. It's not an error. It's just a variant. And variants are what you would expect in eyewitness. Now, if you're going to have to show me, when someone says there's a contradiction, show me you've got a contradiction in Scripture in the New Testament in which I can't also consider it as simply a variant. That means I have to either have an innate distrust so that every variant I just assume is an error, or presuppositional toward trusting it. I don't presuppose everything is true. You don't do that when you work homicides. You presuppose everyone's a liar. Then somebody will eventually go to jail. You don't presuppose anyone's telling you the truth. So I'm always going to test it. But I don't see any reason. What got me interested in the Gospels was that they did not line up. Those little differences, how many women are at the tomb? What's the sign over Jesus' cross say? That stuff that would seem different per account is what sold me. By the way, do you think you'd have any more? Do you think that the skeptic would have more confidence if we had four word for word identical accounts? No, he'd just say that you're all lying. You've all colluded. So you can't win either way with skeptics sometimes. But truthfully, this variation is what I recognized right away. We should test these because this has got starting to smell like a real account, because that's just the nature of eyewitness accounts.
Okay.
And by the way, this is something that historians do too. A lot of the work I'm doing is the same kind of work historians do, but I'm not classically trained as a historian. But here's what's great about working investigations is that historians don't test their inferences in front of juries. They make inferences, and you've seen a lot of historians make false inferences because they have a bias. For example, I'm writing a book right now. And in one chapter of the book, I'm talking about the nature of humans, the fallen nature of humans, the enigma of man. And if you look at the studies that were been done about human nature, you will find that up until about the 1980s, the evil baseline nature of humans was repeated over and over and over again by psychologists, sociologists, historians, philosophers. But then starting around the 80s and 90s, you can tell we've become such a me generation that nobody wants to see themselves as fallen. We want to see ourselves as basically good and corrupted by systems and governments instead of basically fallen and corrupting systems and governments. So because the shift has happened presuppositionally, now suddenly every study is an effort to show the innate goodness, and sometimes it's quite a stretch. But you'll see them trying to do this because there are presuppositional biases. And this is what I think also happens in the reading of Scripture, is that the most severe kind of criticisms of Scripture kind of come out of the German schools of theology, and they're only a couple hundred years old. Up until that time, you didn't assume the worst. We always say this, that you know, in a criminal trial, even though as a detective, I always assume the worst in people, you are to assume the best in people unless you find a reason to distrust them. Don't start from a negative, because you wait. If there's no negatives, don't assume they're lying. If I try everything to prove they're lying and nothing actually sticks to the wall, then you can't still assume they're lying. You need a reason to disregard that witness. So a lot of it is, what's our presuppositional bias when we first read the Gospels? If we just assume up front, these are lies, well, then nothing I can say to you is going to change your mind. I just
make it a lot easier if everyone who swore to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, were actually truth tellers, right? So
yeah, right.
So back to your book, we're seeing those revival on college campuses. We talked about Ashbury in Kentucky and spreading all over. The mini series The Chosen, very popular. The movie out now, Jesus Revolution, just came out to huge box office success. So it adds to your list of art and entertainment that proves even if the New Testament was erased from history, we could know Jesus. Tell us about that non-Christian body of art and science that proved for you Jesus.
Well, I think that most people are just in the science realm. It's remarkable in science and education how much data can be recovered about Jesus, even if you had no New Testament. Now, that's not to say that there's necessarily true data about Jesus, but if he is who he said he was, I would expect him to have his fingerprints over everything he's got. These are the aspects of his creation. And for example, in science, people don't realize that the science fathers, the fathers of every major scientific discipline from astronomy to quantum mechanics, were Christ followers by and large. That's right. The vast majority of people in the scientific revolution were Christ followers. Now, you might say, well, yeah, the 15th and 16th century in Europe, those are all Christians and Catholics, right? I mean, so duh. Yeah, but that's not the point. The point is there were far more people out living outside of Europe than were living inside of Europe. And there were far more non-Christians on planet Earth than there were Christians. Why didn't the scientific revolution take place in Persia or Egypt or Asia? Why ended Christendom in Europe? Because Christendom ignites the sciences in a way that no other worldview ignited them prior or since. And we even stand today on a Western tradition of knowledge that's built on the back of a Christian worldview. So even those who deny Jesus and deny God have to basically sit in his lap in order to do it. So there's the problem, right? So when you look at the influence of the science fathers, they wrote a lot about Jesus in addition to quantum mechanics. And if you look at the notes and the personal letters of the science fathers, the founding fathers of those disciplines, you can learn more about Jesus than you can from the church fathers. The amount of data that's available from the science fathers who were influenced by this guy named Jesus of Nazareth is remarkable. So that if you destroyed every New Testament, but you had the historical writing of the science fathers from the first century to today, but remember that even the science Nobel laureates are dominantly Christian, about 3-1. It's about, take every other group, Jews, Hindus, freethinkers, Buddhists, atheists, agnostics, put them all in one pile, times 3, now you have how many Christians have won that prize. We formed the academies that give awards for the sciences. We've dominated the award winning, including the Nobel Prize.
I wrote that down. Nobel Prizes, 65% Christ followers, the next closest Jewish at 21, and only 7% atheist. And that's probably overstated if they didn't answer the poll question, honestly, or came around later. Regardless, two out of three, that's not bad.
Well, and I can tell you that if you look at the data that we looked at trying to figure out if someone's, people will say to me, well, yeah, you've listed these people as Christ followers, but you don't really know how devoted they were to Jesus. True. That's very true. I don't. They may have been Christ followers in name only. But here's what I don't know. There are far more people we could not identify as Christ followers that we just didn't include on our list than there are Christ followers who might be lukewarm on our list, because the culture has gone back and erased their Christian identity. So there's lots of folks that we spent a year researching the science fathers, okay? But we got to a point where we just don't have the manuscript evidence that can prove their, look, he's got an Anglican priest for a father. He grew up in, okay, it's a good chance he's probably a Christ follower, but nowhere can I see it written anywhere. I'm not counting him as a Christ follower. So there were far more folks who were Christ followers who were not included than are people on that list, and there's hundreds on that list, which I include in the footnotes, that are maybe lukewarm, you might say. So I just think we've underestimated the impact. As a matter of fact, if you look at the top 15 universities in America and the world today, in the world globally, they were all founded, the top 15, all by Christians, even though they may not think much of Jesus now. Yeah. And their buildings were adorned with the facts of the life of Jesus. And the earliest buildings on those campuses, if all you had were those campuses, you could glean the overarching story of Jesus just from the buildings of the top 15 universities in the world. So you'd have to destroy campuses to get rid of the message of Jesus. And that's the kind of thing when you start to see this over and over again.
And most K-12 schools too.
Right.
Not just universities, but
The Reformation was so involved in preschool, elementary school, lower.
Stanford, Cal, Columbia, Yale, Princeton, even Woke, University of Yucky, Washington. I think it's a magnitude of 10 to 1. Like you said, you can see it in their charters and their buildings. Notre Dame, you know, gave Obama an honorary doctorate, even though he was the most pro-choice senator and president ever. When did the university system actually start losing its way?
Yeah, well, I think that's probably the same time that I think that Enlightenment. If you look at how these are usually, you'll see that they'll move away from their Christian identity probably about 140 years ago. Mm-hmm. You'll see that in different universities. So it's all 20th century movement, and some of them held on to their identity for much longer period of time, or at least now would at least give voice to their identity, even though they probably aren't practically somebody you could. Lots of Christian speakers, for example, aren't even allowed on the campuses to speak about the moral claims of Christianity. So I think that the reality of it is that these are schools that, for the most part, still have a shadow of Christian. Look, more schools have been opened, more universities have been opened and subsequently closed by Christians than have been started by non-Christians. That's the dominance. We, you know, the first three universities, Bologna, Paris, and Oxford, those are universities that were formed by Christians, right, by Christ followers. Now, look, it's not like the ancients didn't have a way to educate themselves. Muslims did. Lots of institutions were developed. But the modern university that you're thinking about right now, in which a body of students will come to a campus where you've got resident faculty who are teaching this to eventually award a diploma for completion, that kind of modern university is a Christian invention. And one of the reasons why Christianity dominates the sciences, because it was a lot of the labs and the scientists of the scientific revolution were being trained either on those three campuses or on the 24 daughter campuses that were planted from those three campuses. So what you have is this explosion that the university systems fed into in the sciences. And by the way, there was more groups than just Christians, right, who had contributed heavily in the sciences. As a matter of fact, until about the 13th century, Muslims contributed dramatically to the sciences, but then they've stopped. And there's a book called Closing of the Muslim Mind that kind of explores why. And it's theological reasons, really. This is kind of the inference, is that what happens is if your imams are saying that there's no point in if you ever encounter an alleged apparent contradiction with the Quran's going to win. So stop looking. But what's the point? Everything you need to know is in the Quran. What we have done as a community is said, look, we know that there are times that God reveals himself in two ways, through natural revelation, the world around us, and through special revelation, the world as described in Scripture. And if you find yourself in a point of apparent contradiction, you're either reading the natural revelation wrong, or you're reading the special revelation wrong. You're interpreting it wrong. We know that the sun doesn't really rise and set. It's not that, you know, it's just an observational data point. We see this from our observational standpoint that it rises and sets, but we recognize we didn't stop and say, okay, this is, we have to now explain the science of the natural realm.
But Galileo had to suffer for that for quite a while before.
That's true. Other thing I talk about in the book, right? What, to what degree did he really suffer, and what really got him in trouble? You know, part of the problem with Galileo was not
a Christian.
It was not that he you know, discovered this, because he wasn't the first to pose this.
Right.
But of the three who first posed it, Galileo was the biggest, how shall I say it, jerk. And it was his being a jerk that got him in trouble with the Pope. So a lot of it is, you know, it was dispositional. So anyway, the point I'm trying to make is we are willing, because we recognize that God speaks to us in two different ways, that we have to reconcile those two ways. And scientists have done that. Christian scientists have done that for the entire history of science. That kind of malleability, where we're able to kind of look at it and say, well, maybe in this passage, God means this.
Yeah.
Maybe we've been misinterpreting it.
Yeah.
Well, that struggle. And by the way, we should be allowed to have that struggle, knowing full well that when we get to heaven, God's going to straighten us out.
Yeah, in a democracy at least. And about 150 years before Jesus even arrived on the scene, Rome, who was not Christian at the time, obviously, became Christian, paved the way for his and the exact right time in history by what they do, adopted the Etruscan alphabet and the Greek language, amazing system of roads. This is all pre-internet, obviously. These things had to happen for him, right?
Yes. So what happens is you have a fuse that burns up to the explosion we call Jesus. And that fuse has got several strands. You know, one of them is cultural. You know, if you don't, if he doesn't appear in the Roman Empire, his influence is much more geographically limited. But because he comes in a period of time in which Rome had unified much of the known world, even with roads they had built during peacetime revenue. Remember, when there was the Pax Romana, those 200-year period of peace, it wasn't like Rome wasn't thinking about war. Oh, yeah, it was thinking about war. It was building the infrastructure they could move armies on. But those roads were helpful. As a matter of fact, two or three of the churches mentioned by John in the book of Revelation were planted by Paul on roads that were not available to him about 100 years prior. They were built by the Roman Empire. You know, that expression, all roads lead to Rome, was pretty much what they tried to do, including the Silk Road to China. So now you had an avenue by which you could spread the gospel message globally that you didn't have before. They took all the Persian roads, adopted them, and continued them and added them to all roads led to Rome. So in the end,
at the same time, the Gutenberg press, right? That was
right. These are all little data points.
John Calvin too. Yeah.
They were. If you look at, for example, just the curve, an explosive curve of science, you'll see that as this thing curves up, there are data points along the way that accelerate the curve. You know, the formation of monasteries and cathedral schools before universities, then universities. Then you have, you know, you have the Gutenberg press to make printing materials. You have the Reformation happens to coincide with the scientific revolution. There's lots of data points that may be coincidental or evidence of a catalyst. And that's what we have to kind of decide. Now, again, I can provide that those facts. And my inference is going to be in one direction, but somebody else might look at it and say it's a different inference. But that's fine. The burden is then on the other person to explain to me why that's the better inference.
Yeah. And the calendar, right? 2023. There's a reason it's not 2,223. The Library of Congress, you write about this. I found it fascinating. Has 17,000 plus books about Jesus. And only person even close is Shakespeare at under 10,000. Lenin, 4,500. Abe Lincoln, only 4,000. That tells us he was the person of most interest, the name of your book. Google Books has globally 109 million, followed by George Washington, merely 58 million, and the philosopher King Karl Marx, just 6 million. I'm glad the scales are balanced toward Jesus, you know, and father of our country. But why do you think Marx dominates politics and not Jesus?
Well, I would say, you mean in America, you mean? Well, look,
globally, really.
Yeah. So I think reason why I included Google Books in that is because you could argue that you really can't trust the Library of Congress because it might just be reflecting either a distinctly American collection and interests or distinctly, you know, Western interest. But Google Books, which should give you everything. I mean, you could write a book anywhere in the world and it could appear on Google Books. Now, this is not like scientific, like I've not gone in every one of these books and read it to make sure that probably a lot of these are not even speaking the truth about Jesus. I mean, right. Within Christendom, a lot of our new books are not speaking the truth about Jesus.
They could be even anti-Jesus. They're just in
the... Yeah, but they are focused on Jesus, though. And what's interesting about that, and why do you see that we move away from kind of traditional Orthodox teaching related to Jesus? Because we are at our nature fallen, which means we are driven by the three things that God has given us for beauty that we corrupt for evil. That's the same three reasons why anyone commits a murder. There are only three reasons why anyone commits a lie, tells a lie. There are only three reasons why anyone does something they shouldn't do. There are only three reasons. It's sex, money, and power. That's it. The power group is probably the biggest group. So, you know, it's our pride that if we can bend something to our own advantage, we will. And because we are innately fallen by nature, you cannot fix us by replacing the system. No, we'll figure out a way to game that system because the problem is not the systems. The problem is us. And no matter where we reside and what system we reside in, we'll find a way to corrupt it. So ideas, you know, that we want to take from people who have what we don't have. We want that kind of thing. It's all about us. It's all about us. But I think what people think in a system where everyone would have the same is we think, hey, I see that guy has more than I, or that gal has more than I have. I want to rise to that level. But what usually happens in those systems is that no one rises to this level of equality. We all sink to that level of equality. We have a choice. Some of you can use your God-given gifts and through your own energy and hard work attain certain goals. Or all of you can have nothing. Those are the two options. And I think that we sometimes mistakenly think that the third option, all of you can have everything, is on the table. But that's not on the table. Some of you can have stuff if you'll work hard for it, and some of you won't, or all of you can have nothing. But the idea that all of you can have something is an illusion.
Yeah. Richard Dawkins said Darwin made it possible to become an intellectual, fulfilled atheist. You were sure Jesus' followers in science would decrease, but no, they didn't. You just talked about they increased on the national scene. So you were an atheist before you started all of this, and now you are obviously very enlightened, let's say. What changed your heart?
Well, you don't start. Look, the gospel is not centered on God's fallen nature. It's centered on our fallen nature. But I don't think many people would read that, would read the gospels to see what it says about you when it's going to describe you in a way that's unflattering, unless, of course, they first believe the gospels are speaking the truth. Now, for some of us, we read that and we recognize our own fallenness. We have a certain level of humility, and we right away, well, yeah, that is describing me accurately. I was not one of those people. I needed to know, was the Bible describing Jesus accurately before I could ever trust it to describe Jim accurately? But once I saw that it described Jesus accurately, I was willing to entertain what it said about me. And what it says about me is true, and it's not pretty. So you don't have a need for a savior. You won't run to a savior until you first recognize you have a need. And I just didn't realize I had a need because I wasn't being honest about who I was. And I think, you know, and I think, again, everyone comes at this differently. Our entry point in Christendom has been for too long. Just have an experience that confirms for you that the Christianity is true and you're in. Well, that's true for every worldview. That's how Mormons become Mormons, how Buddhists become Buddhists, how Muslims become Muslims. It hasn't been examined to see if this is evidentially true. And that was the way of Jesus. He said, if you don't believe what I'm telling you, at least believe on the evidence of these miracles I've worked in front of you. And then he spent 40 days giving additional proofs, that's the Greek word for evidence, to the disciples after the resurrection. What is that about?
Yeah. Well, Thomas had to put his fingers in the holes to prove it, right? And you wrote.
But then he says, well, you know, blessed are those who don't have to do this. Yeah, but keep reading, because they're going to believe this, Thomas, on the basis of your testimony, which is what's called direct evidence.
Yeah.
So he's just creating a series of witnesses that he's going to spend 40 days with. There's 120 in the upper room that can go out then and share the gospel on the basis of their observations. You'll notice if you read the book of Acts, nowhere does anyone say, let me tell you how my life was personally changed. I used to be an alcoholic. Now I'm not. You won't see that kind of thing in the book of Acts. Instead, what you'll see is I saw the risen Christ. I'm not kidding. I was heading in this direction and I saw him. You don't even know. Paul doesn't even tell Felix what a different man he is. He talks about how he was a Jew until he saw the risen Christ. It's all risen Christ dependent. Right. So I think that's part of what we get to do is be able to make the case for the resurrection.
And you wrote, if I trust science as much as I claim, why am I unwilling to take seriously what the world's foremost scientists have to say about Jesus? So how prevalent or absent in belief in Jesus and the police work you do, you said you're the only believer in your department, and you must meet a lot of unbelievers trying to solve cases that would actually benefit if they knew Christ like you do.
Well, I'm not the only believer in my department, but I was the only believer on my team of five officers and a sergeant at the time I became a Christian. So there are some believers, but they are definitely in the dramatic minority, right? And a lot of that is because we take a view of the world that is so glass half empty, and we are so you only hire a certain kind of person to do this job. They're probably not a person who's got strong on humility. It's probably a person who's strong on confidence, not afraid to go into that bar fight. That's the kind of person we have to hire in order to survive in this job. And that sometimes is not a person who recognizes that your greatest strength is your first act of humility and accepting the gospel. That's the thing we have to share with officers. We have a website, by the way, called thethinbluelife.com, thethinbluelife.com, where we just talk about Christianity to police officers. And so it's a site for police officers that takes a Christian worldview. The other site, coldcasechristianity.com, is simply a place where you can get a kind of a detective's view of Christianity. So these two sites are kind of the opposite of each other. But the reason why we have that site for police officers is because I think that, I think that the police officers sometimes think you want me to be rational and evidential about my work and then turn that off to be a Christian. Can't go there. And once they realize that actually you can hold on to your evidential nature and become a Christian, I think it's a much easier ask.
Awesome. Well, Mr. Wallace, sir, thank you for your time. We really appreciate you. We are at the end here. Please tell our listeners where they can go to find out even more than those two websites about you and follow your social or anything.
You can go to those websites. All our social is connected there. We also have a kids academy called the Casemaker. It's called casemakersacademy.com. That's where young people learn about the case for Christianity.
Very nice. All right. Well, thanks again for coming on with us.
I appreciate you having me. Thanks. I don't
Welcome to the Steve and Steve segment of our show for you on Rumble. We got a special treat. The music is now in the video where we cover what we just heard. Producer Steve, what did you think of our guest, J. Warner Wallace, and his book, Person of Interest?
Oh, you know me. I love that kind of thing, Steve. And the guy's right on point on so many issues. And if I had been part of the discussion, we would have got past probably the fifth question you had, Steve. But
So thanks for bringing. I had a page and a half left, as I always do.
Thanks for bringing him on. He is a breath of fresh air, a man after my own heart.
Yeah, lots of great video clips of him on YouTube too, if you want to find out more. Let's kick this off with clip number one.
We want to fix the problem. Here's just five things that you should think about doing. Here's number five. And if this doesn't apply to you, if you're not doing this, then it doesn't apply to you. I'm not talking about you. Here's number five. Pull up your pants. Walking around with your ass and your underwear showing is not okay. In fact, it comes from prison when they take away belts from the prisoner so that they can't make a weapon. And then it evolved into which role a prisoner would have during male-on-male prison sex. The one with the really low pants is a submissive one. You get my point? Number four now is the N-word. By promoting the use of that word when it's not germane to the conversation, have you ever considered that you may just be perpetuating the stereotype the master intended, acting like a nigger? Now number three, respect where you live. Start small by not dropping trash, littering in your own communities. I've lived in several predominantly white neighborhoods in my life. I rarely, if ever, witness people littering. I live in Harlem now. It's an historically black neighborhood. Every single day I see adults and children dropping their trash on the ground when a garbage can is just feet away. Just being honest here. Number two, finish school. You want to break the cycle of poverty? Stop telling kids they're acting white because they go to school or they speak proper English. A high school dropout makes on average $19,000 a year. A high school graduate makes $28,000 a year. A college graduate makes $51,000 a year. Over the course of a career, a college grad will make nearly $1 million more than a high school graduate. That's a lot of money. And number one, and probably the most important, just because you can have a baby, it doesn't mean you should, especially without planning for one or getting married first. More than 72% of children in the African-American community are born out of wedlock. That means absent fathers. And the studies show that lack of a male role model is an express train right to prison.
All right. So he said all that about 10 years ago, actually pretty level-headed, I would say. It was the Obama years. Yep. You may have heard it last week, as a matter of fact. I wanted to play it twice because those were the popular views in elite circles. Soon as they became prohibited and it became required to say the opposite, Lemon did a 180, and that's who we have today, demoted to his morning show that nobody's watching, which is probably for the best. It is how the vast majority of people in media function, unfortunately. So let's hear from somebody who's not on board with the new media function.
Have issues with food, there are other things. God, knows the things that he wants you to detach from. Mm. You know, we all know those things that are, you know, make us feel guilty, don't make us feel as good as we should. So being able to detach from those things and focus on, you know, good habits as opposed to bad habits. So there are challenges for fasting, like today I won't have any meat. I'll have one meal today, and I'll do that every Friday throughout Lent and Good Friday. But just challenging people to be better versions of themselves.
It's interesting because I was telling you before, you know, I grew up in a faith background, but not Catholic, so mm-hmm. I have never given up something for Lent. Yeah. This year I did. Now, because I'm not a good Catholic, I thought it was last week, so I actually started last Wednesday.
Well, so you got a head start.
Overachieving.
On
yes, but
that's
I decided I gave up Instagram just because I thought, you know what, I'd like to use the time I might be just scrolling to be doing something else more yeah. reflective and thoughtful. And I found Lent to be interesting because it doesn't have to mean deprivation. It can just mean choosing something else that serves you and connects you to your faith and your community better.
Yes, and ultimately, I just think it gives me, discipline has always been important for me in life. Once I started getting into movies and transitioned from music, I realized I needed a lot of discipline in my life, and that discipline has afforded me so many other things, and I've been rewarded for it so much, and I want to share that with people. So whether that's with fasting, working out more, detaching from other things, and just spending more time with God in prayer or in thoughtful reflection, and those things are important, so.
Your faith means so much to you. Mm. Have you always talked about it, or did you feel at some point like, okay, I have a platform here and I just want to share this part of my journey?
I have. You know, it's a balance. I don't want to jam it down anybody's throat, yeah. but I do not deny my faith. That's an even bigger sin. You know, it's not popular in my industry. But, you know, I cannot deny my faith. Mm-hmm. It's important for me to share that with people. But I have friends from all walks of life and all different types of faiths and religions. So, you know, it's important to respect and honor them as well.
Yeah. What does it mean to you, your faith?
Oh, it's everything. It really has. It's afforded me so many things. Obviously, you know, God didn't come to save the saints. He came to save the sinners. We've all had things and issues in our lives, and we want to be better versions of ourselves. And through focusing my faith, it's allowed me to do that. And I know a lot of people have been challenged with COVID and everything else. I mean, I was away from people and church and community and connection for a long time. But, you know, with people who are wearing masks and they want to, you know, stay away from each other, we want to bring people together.
Community is a big part of a faith practice.
Absolutely.
Not so dumb. That was Mark Wahlberg this last Ash Wednesday. Sometimes Hollywood produces a good actor and a wise person. Not often, but he seems like one. What do you think?
Oh, I appreciated everything he had to say there. I couldn't disagree with his thing, and I've been doing a lot more fasting. My family is doing a lot more fasting just in the course of our life, and the health benefits of that is amazing. And also it just reminds you that we're reliant on God, and if it wasn't for the fact that we live in America, and I was just thinking this, Steve, yesterday, if I lived in the middle of Africa, I would not have a freezer, I wouldn't have electricity, and I'd have to eat day by day. And what we make our culture is, and part of what your guest said, a lot of the inventions that we have and we take for granted all come from a Christian mindset. So I'm very grateful for Christ and how he's permeated our Western way of living. And yeah. We are blessed.
Let's hear from another. Clip 3.
This. The biggest drug cartels in the world get together and buy up all the media and all the politicians and force all the people in the world to stay locked in their homes. And people can only come out if they take the cartel's drugs and keep taking them over and over. I threw the script away. I mean, who is going to believe that crazy idea? Okay, so the movie goes like this.
That was Woody Harrelson on Saturday Night Live. I doubt he'll be invited back. Saturday Night Live has been a force for bad for quite a long time, but there he got up on it and said some truth. Let's hear some more. Clip 4, please.
Fast foods that have no actual food in them. We buy gallons of poisonous household cleaners when one degradable soft soap will do. We are poisoning our homes and wasting our hard-earned money for no good reason. Why? Because the advertising industry tells us to. They just want you to buy stuff. For example, if a company pollutes the environment or uses bad business practices, if you don't buy their stuff, they will change. If you don't want food with chemicals or GMOs in it, then don't buy it. The minute we start taking responsibility and spending our money wisely, Every politician, every corporation, and leader around the world is going to know that we have woken up. This is the 21st century. If we use our resources wisely, there's no reason why anyone shouldn't have what they need. There's no reason whatsoever why people are still starving to death on our planet. And the common man or woman, whether they are Israeli or Palestinian, Protestant or Catholic, or Iraqi or American, the common man just wants to live in peace and justice in a clean environment. Yep. When we look around the world and we see that that is not the case, we know that the will of the majority is not being listened to. That's the first sign that our system is broken. Government won't make these changes for us. Yet again, it is down to the common man. No company will continue a practice or a product that you, the consumer, will not buy. It's vitally important that you understand this because this gives you ultimate power to change the world you live in. Companies are extremely sensitive about you buying their products because if you don't buy their stuff, they go out of business. That's not something any company is willing to consider. And by choosing to spend your money wisely, you can promote those companies that do business in a socially responsible way.
You going to get this guy on your show, Steve?
Working on it. But in the meantime, we have one more clip from him.
Noting that we have to do all of these things, right? I don't like profiteering in war, you know?
Right.
Think of the billions of dollars that have gone to Big Pharma. But I was getting back to my original point. The last people I would trust with my health is Big Pharma and big government, because neither one of those strike me as caring entities.
Spoken,
you know,
as the perfect redneck hippie. Really, if that message doesn't...
They're all about profit.
Exactly.
They're all about profit.
And both sides
and
know that.
It's obscene, the profit they've made.
I think they've done a lot of studies about vitamin D and how important it was when the people who had low levels, they were much more vulnerable to COVID. Why not tell people that? Can't you make money selling vitamin D? Is it that kind of, what's the worst that could happen?
But that's just it, man. There was only one thing, you know, ivermectin got made into a, you know, horse tranquilizer, a horse, whatever it is.
Which it is, but also used by humans.
It's used by millions and millions of humans. Hydroxychloroquine got made ridiculous. And there was only one thing that could work, and that's the vaccine, right? And so ultimately, because of that, billions of dollars was made.
Yeah, trillions.
Yeah. So it's not just me and you, Steve. There's other people out there. I had to dig deep to find some folks in Hollywood that would agree with that, but there you go. So not only has hell showing signs of freezing over in California with the most snow they've seen in decades, but check this out. A sign of the apocalypse in left-wing media, as a matter of fact. CNN guest snaps on air over Democrats ignoring suffering of Americans in East Palestine because they voted for Trump, admits quiet part out loud. Clip number six.
For the neoliberals who say that the residents of that area deserve what they are getting because they voted for President Donald J. Trump, it is abhorrent. Mm. This is about poverty. This is about poor working class white people who are enduring some of the same things that poor working class black people endure, whether it's Flint, Cleveland, or Jackson, Mississippi. And so I want to lay it out. The cultist behavior in politics right now, it is a sin and a shame that when people are suffering to this magnitude, you got people who will fix their mouths, to quote my grandmother, to say that they are getting what they deserve. What they deserve is clean air, clean food, clean water. They deserve relief, both in the short term and also in the long term.
Amen, sister.
Amen. And that was CNN. So all of a sudden, voices are creeping out into the formerly forbidden zones. So I played two smart actors. Two and a half, you can put Bill Maher in there, speaking truth out loud. Let's hear the Breaking Bad star, Bryan Cranston. Did you watch that show, Breaking Bad, Steve?
No, my son's watched it, but I watched another show that's like watching a train wreck happening in slow motion, and I really can't watch many of those shows, and he was one of those.
Yeah, I saw a few of season one. It was too dark for me too. Probably led to a lot of stay-at-home drug dealing, because that's what the premise was. Bad idea, folks. Here he tries to tell us how smart he is, but shows he's anything but. Clip seven.
We treated other human beings as slaves, and we're okay with that. When I see the Make America Great Again, my comment is, do you accept that that could possibly be construed as a racist remark? And most people, a lot of people go, how could that be racist? Make America great again? I said, so just ask yourself from an African-American experience, when was it ever great in America for the African-American? When was it great? So if you're making it great again, it's not including them. So it's to teach us in the woke world to open up and accept the possibilities that our privilege has created blind spots for us. And maybe I haven't seen what is really happening yet.
Maybe you haven't seen a black person with a Make America Great Again hat on. Well, guess what, partner? As you can see, I happen to be black. And I would not be wearing this hat if it was racist. And let's get something else straight, okay? You don't get to speak for me, Jack, okay? So while you sitting there talking about what black people think and about black people's experiences, you don't get to speak for me, okay? So next time you want to speak for me, you better check yourself before you wreck yourself, okay? I love this country. I love America, okay? This is the greatest country in the world. And you know what? It wasn't always perfect, but what country was? Explain to me, please tell me, what country was perfect? No country has ever been perfect at all, okay? And you want to talk about when America was great? Okay, America had plenty of great moments. America was great when Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves.
Yes.
Yeah, when he freed the slaves, America was great. Yes, we still have problems. Yes, we still have problems, but what's better than freedom? There's nothing better than freedom, okay? And if it wasn't for Abraham Lincoln, I probably wouldn't be here right now. If it wasn't for Abraham Lincoln, there would probably be no Barack Obama. There would probably be no Martin Luther King Jr. There probably wouldn't have been a Martin Luther King Jr. or an Oprah Winfrey. So thank God that Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves, okay? America had plenty of great moments. Then segregation ended. America was great when that ended, okay? Yes, black people probably still have problems, but guess what? This is the greatest country in the world, and look at where we are now. Look at that. And I'm proud to be an American.
There you go. So Bryan Cranston, like most Hollywood actors, are complete idiots when they're not handed a script. It's amazing to me just how dumb they are in real life sometimes. Back to the news, because that's where the smart people are. Clip number eight.
Science, not presidential politics. And the scientists aren't the only ones rankled today by Trump's effort at reputational repair. The New York Times also advances recent reporting on U.S. intelligence agencies, which we learned this week provided intel in the president's PDB as early as January about the lethal spread of COVID. Those same agencies now have been tapped with investigating one of Trump world's most favorite conspiracy theories. New York Times reports this, quote, senior Trump administration officials have pushed American spy agencies to hunt for evidence to support an unsubstantiated theory that a government lab in Wuhan, China was the origin of the coronavirus outbreak. That's according to current and former American officials. The effort comes as President Trump escalates a campaign to blame China for the pandemic. Some intel analysts are concerned that the pressure from the administration officials will distort assessments about the virus and that they could be used as a political weapon in an intensifying battle with China over a disease that has infected more than 3 million people across the globe. The stories of Trump reaching deep into the government agencies charged with science, traditional.
This was when MSNBC's Nicole Wallace eviscerated Donald Trump for pushing what she said was a conspiracy theory that COVID escaped from a Chinese lab at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Oops, as we now definitively know. This is why you should not say anything with absolute certainty. This is why you should not cancel anyone for tweeting. This is why you should be humble and tell ourselves every time, what if I'm wrong? What if COVID indeed came from a lab? What if masks do not really work? What if vaccines are not as effective as Pfizer wants the world to believe while making billions of dollars? Finally, this is why you should not dismiss people from the other side of political divide as conspiracy theorists, election deniers, and all the rest. Do not look down on people. Do not demonize others. You're never smarter than others in the way you believe that you are. Steve, she's back. My hero is back. She was over there fighting the Russians in Ukraine single-handedly like a short, fat Audie Murphy and negotiating deals to get schools open and masks off in a hurry. And now she's making headlines. She's
in a rainbow parachute, I'll bet, too. In her rainbow pantsuit.
Yep, maybe. She's fighting the good fight on the Supreme Court steps, no less, earning her $600,000 salary, fighting for the little guy. Don't forget, the underpaid teachers and janitors and school nurses. No, not really. She's into student loan forgiveness now. Sorry to have to do this to you, but let's hear from the late, great Randy Weingarten.
This is what really pisses me off. During the pandemic, we understood that small businesses were hurting, and we helped them, and it didn't go to the Supreme Court to challenge it. Big businesses were hurting, and we helped them, and it didn't go to the Supreme Court to challenge it. All of a sudden, when it's about our students, they challenge it, the corporations challenge it, the student loan lenders challenge it. That is not right, that is not fair, and that is what we are fighting as well when we say, cancel student debt.
Incoherent communist yelling, I call that clip. But wait, there's more. What else did she say?
All of a sudden, when it's about our students, they challenge it, the corporations challenge it, the student loan lenders challenge it. That is not right. That is not fair. All of a sudden, when it's about our...
Is that the one you wanted?
Yes. Okay. I raised the octave a few, but still incoherent, just funnier. But that right there is an ad for homeschooling. 23 Baltimore schools have zero students proficient in math. State results reveal zero students proficient in math in 19 Minnesota schools. State hits 30-year low. Illinois public schools, among more than 30 institutions of learning, zero students can read at their respective grade levels. As for math, across 53 schools, no students are proficient. Test scores show how teachers' union head Randy Garden damaged an entire generation of kids. Way to go, Randy. Let's end on this. Remember the left was all anti-war and hippie and give peace a chance? Play clip number 11.
The U.S. will have to send their sons and daughters exactly the same way as we are sending their sons and daughters to war, and they will have to fight because it's NATO that we're talking about, and they will be dying, God forbid, because it's a horrible thing.
Oh,
Zelensky, that was an interpreter, says the United States will have to send their sons and daughters to die to defend NATO. $150 billion and our kids, blood and treasure for NATO expansion and World War III while China continues to pick our pockets. No, thank you. I love my kids. Stay tuned for my thought of the week. Folks, Rumble, new music, I'm all screwed up. But okay, we're getting through it. Welcome to my quote for the day. But before I share, I want to remind everyone to subscribe to Mill Creek View Podcast. Just go to Rumble or Spotify or iTunes and hit the subscribe button and follow us. While you're there, leave a comment. I'll read it on air. And thanks for doing it. Hopefully, these aren't new to you, but if they are, just know Jesus and God love you very much. Jesus answered, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me, John 14:6. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well, Matthew 6:33. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. Matthew 5:16. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Mark 10:45. Let the little children come to me and do not hinder them, for the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these. Matthew 19:14. Go be like kids, okay? That's it for this episode. Really hope you like it. Thank you, J. Warner Wallace, to investigating truth and telling us about it. Until next time, this is your host, Steve Abramowitz, owner and operator and editor-in-chief of mcview.us. Peace in our time.
County Fair. They were looking for America behind every turn, flying the very colors that so many love to burn. I'll cruise the countryside with my dad and my brother, row after row of cotton and corn, moving through this place just like rolling thunder.
Any views or opinions represented on the podcast are personal and belong solely to the creator and do not represent those of people, institutions, or organizations that the creator may or may not be associated with in a professional or personal capacity unless explicitly stated.